We've read it several times already, but I'd like to go back to our text for this series again for this message, and that being 2 Peter chapter 3 and verses 14 through 17. 2 Peter chapter 3, verses 14 through 17. In verse 14 it says, "Therefore, beloved, since you look for these things, be diligent to be found in him by peace, spotless and blameless, and regard the patience of our Lord to be salvation, just as also our beloved brother Paul, according to the wisdom given him, wrote to you, as also in all his letters, speaking to them of these things, in which are some things hard to understand, which the untaught and the unstable distort, as they do also the rest of the Scriptures to their own destruction. You therefore, beloved, knowing this beforehand, be on your guard, lest being carried away by the error of unprincipled men, you fall from your own steadfastness." You know, that's probably a passage that I don't probably really need to worry about reading before this congregation and to the hundreds of people who are on the tape ministry, because they just almost naturally seem to be a people who understand that there are unprincipled, ungodly men who distort the Scriptures. But there are people occasionally who receive these messages, and specifically with this particular series, I know they'll be going to some people who need to be encouraged again and again to understand and to be warned that there are indeed those type of people out there. And who knows? It could be me, or it could be the next guy. And there's only one way for us to know and to be able to determine who is this type of person being described here by the Apostle Peter. And that is for us to not take them at their word, but to govern and to judge everything they say, not by what they say, but by what God says, by His Word. And I encourage and I admonish you again to do that. My primary reason for choosing this text was because of the distortion of specifically Paul's writings I witnessed in Sioux City, Iowa a few months back at a meeting in which the truth of the Christian Israel message was being attacked. At this meeting, our specific beliefs were without a doubt distorted. Old Testament Scripture was distorted, and New Testament Scripture was distorted, which I believe I've already adequately demonstrated and proven in the previous messages. But especially, well, at least what jumped out at me was especially Paul's writings were being distorted even as much or more than the other things already mentioned. And I'm convinced that if you misinterpret Paul's writings, you will do more damage to the intent of the Scriptures than any other one New Testament writer. In the last message, we began to examine specifically some of the distortions of Paul's writings by John Clark in his attempt to discredit the Christian Israel message. And we left off with the book of Romans. I'd like to pick up with this particular message with John Clark's arguments from the book of Galatians. This will be, again, I'll let you listen to him specifically on this one. This will be from side one of tape two.
What I'm going to be affirming in this is that the Bible teaches that all human beings upon the earth have a right, because of what Christ did and because of the gospel, to become Abraham's seed. The whole plan of God was that all human beings would be offered an opportunity to become the children of God by faith in Christ Jesus. And when they did that, it would be Abraham's seed.
Okay, could you hear that? Okay, following his statements. Now, keep in mind, first of all, that what he was saying is that every person, every human being, has the right not just to salvation, but to become Abraham's seed or descendants. Now, following those statements that John Clark, you just heard of John Clark, he cites Galatians 3:26. Through 29 as his quote-unquote proof for what he just stated. So let's turn to Galatians chapter 3. Let's read verses 26 through 29. Verse 26 beginning, it says, "For you are all sons of God through faith in the Christ Yeshua. For all of you who were baptized into the Christ have clothed yourselves with the Christ. There is neither Jew nor Greek, there is neither slave nor free man, there is neither male nor female, for you are all one in the Christ Yeshua. And if you belong to the Christ, then you are Abraham's offspring, heirs according to the promise. Now anyone with half a mind can see that under the new covenant, anyone from any nation or race of people who in faith come to Christ, that they are descendants of Abraham. Anyone can see that Paul is here describing spiritual descendants of Abraham, not physical descendants of Abraham. Isn't that exactly or basically the way they put it or what they say was based on what they read there in Galatians 3:26 through 29? And I'll have to admit, it's not been all that long ago, that many years ago, that was my argument from Galatians chapter 3 in the last four or five verses there. But let me ask you, is that position biblically sound? That Paul is here addressing or discussing spiritual descendants of Abraham and not physical descendants? You know, we've dealt with, in the last, I think, at least the last message, if not the last two messages, we've dealt before with this spiritual Israel concept. But this is probably the most often used passage to do so, that people try to say that the New Testament or under the New Covenant we're only dealing with a spiritual Israel rather than a physical Israel. Now those who teach a spiritual Israel under the New Covenant will have to admit that their interpretation of this passage is totally dependent upon their definition of the two words Jew and Greek in this verse 28. Now they assume that the word Jew is synonymous with the terms Israel or Israelites, descendants of any or all 12 tribes of Israel, which we've certainly dealt with in the past. And they also assume that the word Greek, as it's used contrasted with the word Jew, means all non-Israelite people or persons. Now let me state this just as emphatically as I can. If their definitions, as I just shared them with you, if their definitions for these two words is correct, then their interpretation of this passage is correct as well. However, it must also be understood that if their definitions for these two words are incorrect, then they have no choice, but we have no choice to conclude that they have come to the wrong conclusions concerning this passage as well. I basically dealt with that very position, and you've heard this before, at least most of you here, if not all of you, in a letter I wrote to another preacher back in 1990. Let me just read to you again this, because I think it illustrates my point probably better than I just stated it. I wrote on page 2 of this letter, I said, "Many of your arguments found in your newsletter sounded as if they came right from my mouth 4 or 5 years ago. When I was first introduced to what is most often known as Israel identity, (parentheses, not British Israelism, the two have some glaring differences, end of parentheses), I couldn't believe anyone could fall for such a doctrine, especially when it seemed to be so easily refuted from the scriptures. And for the next 2 years, I worked at trying to refute it using some of the same arguments found in your letter. It seemed so obvious until I really started examining what the scriptures teach. As I studied, I found that I had never given the correct biblical, as I studied, I found that I had never been given the correct biblical definitions for two key words, Jew and Gentile. You know, if one has the wrong definition for something, it is then very easy to also come up with totally wrong conclusions concerning the same thing. As a matter of fact, it is nearly 100% certain that you will come up with the wrong conclusions. For example, if your mother had taught you when you were a child that a turkey walked on four legs, had a long tail, and said moo, then more than likely, any time you spoke about turkeys from that point on, you would be making false conclusions based on the original definitions given you. It would probably be, at least initially, hard to convince you otherwise. After all, your mother, (parentheses, college professors, denomination, etc., end parentheses, couldn't be wrong. And how much more so if the whole society had been taught the same way? But no matter how many people, authorities or otherwise, believed and taught that a turkey walked on four legs, had a long tail, and said moo, wouldn't make it so. This is exactly what has happened when it comes to the most of the modern-day teaching concerning Jew and Gentile. As I am sure you will see, given the right definition, it puts a whole different light on the scriptures." Now, that is exactly what the scenario that we find ourselves in today. Modern-day teachers have erroneously taught that the Jews in the Bible are all Israel, that they are descendants of all 12 tribes of Israel and have made them synonymous, and that everyone else is a Gentile or Greek. Or in other words, they say that they're all non-Israelites. But let's look at the correct definitions again, at the correct definitions for these two words, and we've already dealt with some of them previously. The biblical use of the word Jew, as I've shared with you before, refers only to the descendants of the house of Judah. And again, that just makes sense. The United Kingdom of all 12 tribes at one point in their history were divided into two houses, the house of Israel and the house of Judah. And the term Jew, or better translated Judahite, never came into existence until after those two houses split and divided. And which one do you think Judahite or Jew would refer to? The house of Israel? No, the house of Judah, which consisted only of the tribe of Benjamin and Judah. Now, it never in the Bible refers to all 12 tribes. And again, as I've challenged in so many times before in previous messages, I challenge anyone to go to the Scriptures and find anywhere, prove to me from a Bible passage that the term Jew refers to all 12 tribes of Israel. John Clark certainly has not proven it thus far. Also in the Bible, we have the word Greek. In this particular passage, that's the word that's used in contrast to the word Jew. In the Bible, the word Greeks is used interchangeably with the word Gentiles. We need to understand that. And let me prove it to you by one particular passage. 1 Corinthians chapter 1. Verses 1 and 3. Listen to how they switch back and forth. In verses 22 through 24, it says, "For indeed Jews ask for signs, and Greeks search for wisdom, but we preach the Christ crucified, to the Jews a stumbling block, and to Gentiles foolishness. But to those who are the called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God." And throughout the New Testament, you'll find that those two terms, translated from two different Greek words. The word Greek comes from the Greek word Hellen, and the word English word Gentile is translated from the Greek word ethnos. But you'll find an interchangeable use in almost every case of those two terms, so that when we know when a passage is dealing with Greeks, you can just about bet they're also dealing with Gentiles. Consequently, Greek, as used in Galatians 3 and verse 28, could be replaced with the word Gentile without doing any harm to the intent or meaning of that particular passage. And I really don't think there would be any argument from anybody over that. So we could simply replace it with Gentile. With that being the case, we need to also again look at the word Gentile. The word Gentile is translated again from the Greek word ethnos, and as I'm sure all of you know here, it has at least five different biblical applications or definitions. In spite of the fact that many today believe that the word Gentile or Greek or the Greek word ethnos means exclusively non-Israelite people. And you'll hear the biggest majority of people, and that's exactly what I used to believe and teach, that it means just non-Israelite people. And yet that simply is not the fact for anybody who will study that Greek word ethnos out. It's funny, too, because John Clark, remember in a couple messages back, he was claiming that we believe that the word Gentile means exclusively Israelites. And of course, I shared that was a distortion of our beliefs, and I shared with you and the tape audience that simply is not the case. The context must determine. He said that it was us who used an exclusive use of that term for all Israelites, and yet he's one, and people like him, who believe that it's exclusively used for non-Israelite people. We've gone through these passages before, but let me cite to you the five different applications or definitions for this word ethnos. It's translated, for example, nations, and used in reference to non-Israelites in Acts chapter 7 and verse 45. That's just one place where that is the case. Secondly, it's translated pagans and used in reference to heathens in 1 Corinthians chapter 12 and verse 2. Thirdly, it's translated nation and used in reference for a multitude of people, specifically in the case I'm going to cite, for the whole human race in Acts chapter 17, verse 26. Fourthly, it's translated nation again and used in reference of Jewish people. Now keep in mind, many today want to say it's exclusively used for all non-Israelite people. But there's three times in the New Testament that the term ethnos, or the word ethnos, is used for Jewish or Judahite or descendants of the house of Judah people, as in the case of Luke 7, verses 3 through 5. And then also as translated Gentiles, used in reference to the descendants of the house of Israel, which we've proven in previous messages, as found in Romans 9 and verse 24. Again, we've looked at those all in detail in the past, so I don't want to do that again. But we've got, again, we have five choices. And it would be, with five choices, it would be absolutely foolish or downright dishonest for any of us just to simply take whichever one of those of those five biblical applications and apply it to any particular biblical passage that happens to suit our fancy or our doctrinal position. Or I should say, to take the application that suits our fancy or our doctrinal position. We can't do that. So what do we do? I mean, I don't know how many times I've asked this question in the same regard in this series. What do? We've got five different possibilities. First, what do? We've got to look at the context of every passage, don't we? There's just no other way around it. And even John Clark agreed with me on this point, at least in a manner of speaking. Listen to what he said. This is from side one of take seven.
And that's where we get into this issue about to the Jew first and also to the Greek. And then someone gets into a word study with regard to what the word Greek means. And in that text, the same concept as the Jew and the Gentile. Now, to try to make the Greek there just a Greek-speaking Israelite, you see, that kind of thing has implications, using words in that way. We need to study context and determine how it's being used in that place.
So, John Clark, at least in a manner of speaking, agreed with me. The context has to be determined. And again, on that particular message, he was again dealing with the same passage. But the only problem with what John Clark stated is that he never really studied the context. He jumped back to a couple verses, but as far as really looking at the context of what was being dealt with there, he never did that. And yet he says the context has to determine what's really being dealt with there. We will study the context, and that's what the rest of this message will be doing. So what does the context of Galatians 3 say about these Greeks or Gentiles in verse 28? Let's begin by asking, to whom was the book of Galatians written? Well, of course, the place to find out is to go back to the first of the book and find out who Paul addresses there in the first couple verses of Galatians chapter 1. Galatians chapter 1, verse 1, it says, Paul, an apostle, not sent from men, nor through the agency of man, but through Yeshua the Christ and God the Father who raised him from the dead, and all the brethren who are with me to the churches of Galatia. Now, most of us understand that the word church or churches is translated from the Greek word ekklesia, and it means those who are called out or the saved ones. And so it's an obvious answer that Paul had written this letter to the people of Galatia who had responded to salvation in Yeshua the Christ. Now, that helps us a lot, doesn't it? Well, what we need to do is ask, well, who were the Galatians? The book of Galatia was obviously written to the Galatians, specifically to those saved ones in Galatia, again, who had responded to the gospel. But who were the Galatians? That's the question that needs to be asked. Well, let's go to 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 1, and we find there a very important clue. 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 1, it says, Peter, an apostle of Yeshua the Christ, to those who reside as aliens scattered throughout Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia, who are chosen. Now, using the American or the English translation alone, that's not yet very helpful. But if we go back to the original language, which we need to do whenever we can, to really get an understanding of what's the point that's being brought across by the writer of any particular book or letter, when we go back, and especially in regards to one word here, the word scattered, if we go back and we'll look at the Greek definition for that particular word, it all of a sudden sheds great light on who Peter here is addressing. Again, it says, Peter, an apostle of Yeshua the Christ, to those who reside as aliens scattered. That word scattered there is number 1290 in Strong's Concordance. It's the Greek word diaspora. And Strong defines that word as Israelite residents in Gentile countries. It's used, that word is used three different times in the New Testament. We'll look at the one of the other times. It's later in the message. It's also found in James 1:1. There it was translated as dispersion. I don't know why they didn't translate it that way here. Sarah Fenton does. I think maybe the King James does as well. New American Standard translated it scattered. But it had been much better translated as people of the dispersion, specifically, as Strong says, Israelite residents in Gentile countries. And because that's what the dispersion was. It was that dispersion of those who went into the Assyrian captivity, those of the house of Israel, and actually the biggest part of the house of Judah as well, who went into the Assyrian captivity and were dispersed abroad into Gentile countries. And that has to be, one has to understand that meaning of that word to understand correctly who Peter is writing to. Now, with that understanding, or with that inserted into the verse, let me read it again. It says, Peter, an apostle of Yeshua the Christ, to those who reside as aliens, Israelite residents in Gentile countries, throughout Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, Bithynia, who are chosen. What was one of the places that was named where these Israelite residents were scattered out amongst? Galatia. Now, keep this in mind, that those are the people whom Peter, without question, was writing to. And there's all kinds of evidence throughout the rest of the first epistle of Peter, especially chapter 2, all kinds of evidence that he is dealing with Israelite people only who were scattered in Galatia. So he's dealing with Israelites in his epistle. Now, the Apostle Paul was a contemporary, as we know, of the Apostle Peter, and don't you think that he was probably writing to the very same people? Israelites scattered in Galatia. At least that's a strong possibility. Now, that alone doesn't prove 100% who the Greeks or the Gentiles were in Galatians 3:28, but it's certainly something that does need to be considered. But since that doesn't necessarily prove it completely, let's move on into context. Let's go back to Galatians chapter 3 and look at verse 7. Verse 7 it says, Therefore be sure that it is those who are of faith who are sons of Abraham. Now, this is another verse that is often quoted by those who try to spiritualize Israel under the new covenant. But this verse taken alone, as translated in our English versions today, does not support the concept of a spiritual Israel under the new covenant or in this particular passage. Now, granted, if the those spoken of in this verse refers to non-Israelite Gentiles, and keep in mind that very clearly the word ethnos that's translated Gentiles in our English versions can be Israelite Gentiles or non-Israelite Gentiles. But if the those, I give this to you, granted, if the those in this verse are speaking of non-Israelite Gentiles, then we must conclude that the sons of Abraham in this verse are spiritual sons rather than physical sons. I will give them that. But on the other hand, if the those in this verse refers to literal Israelites, either from the house of Judah or the house of Israel, then it must be concluded that only physical Israelites who are of faith are or will be sons of Abraham. Now, I know that may be a little bit confusing, and for the sake of those who get the tape, they can replay it. But it's two possibilities. The point is that verse in and by itself cannot prove either position, at least as translated in the English versions. However, if we take a look at the interlinear Greek English New Testament, written by Pastor Alfred Marshall, or translated by Pastor Alfred Marshall, we're provided a clue which helps us to determine which is the correct interpretation. Now, for those who may not know, either here or on the tape ministry, what a Greek interlinear is, it's simply a Greek manuscript of the New Testament. The Greek is right there in the text. And then they bring down, instead of changing the sentence structure to make it flow better in English, they simply just bring down the word underneath each Greek word. They just simply bring down the English word. It's the most literal translation that we could have of the New Testament scriptures. Here is how This is translated in the Greek interlinear Greek-English New Testament by Pastor Marshall. Verse 7 reads thusly. It says, "Know ye then that the ones of faith, these sons are of Abraham." Let me read it to you again. Listen carefully. It says, "Know ye then that the ones of faith, these sons are of Abraham." The implication being that they were already some kind of sons, but they were only considered true sons if they were of faith. The faith of Abraham implicating faith in Yeshua the Christ. I checked with the Iliff School of Theology on this, and I think, it's been some years back, but I checked with another theological school, with the Greek scholars, those who teach Greek at those schools, if that literal translation was a legitimate translation of this verse. The reply back was, yes, it is. That can be understood exactly as Marshall's has it there. In other words, those who are already physical sons, according to this literal translation, those who are already physical sons, Israelites in other words, who are of faith, are recognized as being truly of Abraham. Just being a physical descendant of Abraham, in God's sight, didn't make you of Abraham. You not only had to have physical descent, but you also had to have the faith of Abraham. So we can see that this verse that so often, matter of fact, John Clark in his presentations tried to use this verse to say, see, it's spiritual, but it all depends on who the those are in this, the those in this passage are referring to. It could be referring to non-Israelite Gentiles or Israelite Gentiles. According to the interlinear, certainly would point the evidence being that he's dealing with physical Israelites who are now at this time Gentiles. Let's go on further into the context. Let's look at verses 23 through 25. It says, "But before faith came, we were kept in custody under the law, being shut up to the faith which was later to be revealed. Therefore the law has become our tutor to lead us to the Christ, that we may be justified by faith. But now that faith has come, we are no longer under a tutor." Now notice in these three verses, it talks about we. Paul addresses we. Well, who's the we in these passages? Well, the we in these passages are the you he talks about in verses 26 through 27. He says, "For you are all sons of God through faith in the Christ Yeshua. For all of you who are immersed into the Christ, or baptized into the Christ, have been clothed with the Christ." The we of those first three verses are the same basically as the you of the next two verses. But who are the you in those next two verses? Well, they are those described as Jew and Greek in verse 28, where it says, there is neither Jew nor Greek, there is neither slave nor free man, so forth and so on. So, my point is that we know that the we in the first three verses are the you in the next two verses, and the you in the next two verses are described as either being Greek or Jew. And so we know those we that we're discussing in those first three verses are represented in both Jew and Greek. But let's go back to verses 23 through 25, and Paul describes there the people who are both Jews and Greeks as being under the law. Listen to it again. It says, "But before faith came, we," these Jews and Greeks that are represented later, "we were kept in custody under the law." And it continues to the rest of the verses. Okay, so he's dealing with Jews and Greeks who are under the law. But let me ask you, who was it who was under the law? Who was considered under law? Who had possession of the law? And who was considered under the law by the Scriptures? I mean, we can say who we may think it was, but it really doesn't matter who we think it was. Who do the Scriptures say that had the law, who were the possessors of the law, and who were under the law? Well, let's go back to some passages, and let's determine it by the Bible itself. Let's go back to Deuteronomy chapter 33 to begin with. And if you don't get there when I'm there, just listen, and we can continue and get through this. Deuteronomy chapter 33 and verse 4, it says, "Moses charged us with a law, a possession for the assembly of Jacob." Jacob's name, of course, was changed to Israel, and he became the father of the Israelites. Let's go to Psalm 78 and verse 5. It Psalm 78 and verse 5, it says, "For he established a testimony in Jacob and appointed a law in Israel, which he commanded our fathers that they should teach them to their children." Again, a possession of Israel. And then also look at Romans chapter 9. Let's just not determine this from the Old Testament, but let's look at Romans chapter 9 and verse 4. Let's add verse 3 to it. It says, "For I could wish that I myself were accursed, separated from the Christ, for the sake of my brethren, my kinsmen, according to the flesh, who are Israelites, to whom belongs the adoption as sons, and the glory, and the covenants, and the giving of the law, and the service and the promises." Note it was men of the flesh, Israelites, who had been given the law, according to Paul here in this New Testament passage. Now those passages plainly teach what every preacher across this land already knows. The law was given to the Israelites. It was the Israelites who were under the law. It belonged to them, and not only did it belong to them, and not only were they the ones who were under its requirements, not only that, but it was also only given to Israel. Turn back to Psalms 147. And I apologize to at least you here and some on the tape ministry. I know this is repetition again for you. But again, this is something that we had to deal with again because of the arguments that were levied against what we teach. But listen to Psalms 147, verses 19 and 20. Again, it says, "He declares his words to Jacob, his statutes and his ordinances to Israel. He has not dealt thus with any nation, and for his ordinances they have not known them." Not only was it given to Israel, it was given only to Israel. Now with that, the Greeks, keep in mind that Paul was addressing both Greeks and Jews who were under the law. But with what we find in these passages, it is very clear that the Greeks in this passage can be no one else but Israelite Gentiles rather than non-Israelite Gentiles. Let's go back to Galatians 3. Look a little more at the context. Galatians 3 and verse 29, it says, and listen to the emphasis that's here. It says, "And if you belong to Christ, then you are Abraham's offspring, heirs according to the promise." The emphasis is on the word "if" and the word "then." If you belong to Christ, then you are Abraham's offspring. In other words, now that we know that according to the context, according to the fact that it was Greek or Gentile Israelites who could be the only ones being described as being under the law, that here what's happening is that it's the implication being that only Israelites, Jew or Gentile, or Jew or Greek, who belong to the Christ are true descendants of Abraham in God's sight. Just like we've seen in Romans chapter 2 and last message in Romans chapter 9, same thing. We can also see the same thing that also takes place in 1 Peter chapter 3. Now keep in mind, that we've already established from 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 1 that Peter was writing to Israelites. In chapter 3, and listen to verse 6, now Peter's writing this epistle to Israelites, those of the dispersion. In verse 3, in verse 6, he says, "You, who are physical," in this case he's dealing with only women, he says, "You," basically, "who are the physical daughters of Sarah," he says, "you have truly become her children if you do what is right without being frightened by any fear." But let me ask you, if Peter was writing to Israelites, weren't these daughters that he's dealing with here, or these women that he was dealing with here, weren't they already Israelites physically? Of course they were. But he was saying, in God's sight, you must do this as well. You've got to be spiritual daughters, in other words. You've got to follow in the footsteps of Sarah, just like we've been encouraged to follow in the footsteps of Abraham. He was saying specifically to the daughters of Israel, he says, you've got to follow in the footsteps of the faith or the spirituality of Sarah. And then I'll consider you really the daughters of Sarah. So you see the same kind of terminology. He was dealing with physical people, but he was saying, hey, you're not really considered God's people just because of that. There has to be more to it. Now, thus far, we've examined the three verses preceding the passage that's in question that we're dealing with. So now let's examine the five verses which immediately following them. And what we're doing is simply dealing with the context, right? Especially the immediate context of the verses under question, to try to determine which of the five biblical applications is the one that rightly should be applied to this word Greeks in this passage. Now, so let's examine Galatians 4, which the next five verses is the beginning of the next chapter. Galatians 4, verses 1 through 5. Let me get turned back there. Galatians 4, verse 1, it says, "Now I say, as long as the heir is a child, he does not differ at all from the slave, although he is the owner of everything. But he is under guardians and managers until the date set by the father. So also we, while we were children, were held in bondage under the elemental things of the world. But when the fullness of time came, God sent forth his Son, born of a woman, born under the law, in order that he might redeem those who were under the law, that we might receive the adoption of sons." Now, in those five verses, we're provided with three more clues which help us to determine who these Greeks were in chapter 3 and verse 28. The first clue is that, again, he addresses that these people who he's talking or dealing with are those under law, which we've already discussed. The second clue is in verse 5, he says, "in order that he might redeem those who were under law." The second clue is that he's going to redeem those who are under law. Now note, it says nothing about redeeming those who were not under law. Why? Why wouldn't Yeshua want to redeem those who were not under law? Well, simply put, because he couldn't. He could purchase them, but he couldn't redeem them. And the reason for that is because the word redeem or redemption means to buy back. And he could only Israelites who had been a possession of Yahweh's previously and had been divorced and sold by God away could be bought back or redeemed, because that's what the word means. Only those who had been under law could be redeemed or bought back. Now, to prove to you that Israel was his possession, or for those at least in the tape, I know you don't need to have it proven to you, but Exodus chapter 19, in verses 5 and 6 to begin with, listen to what it says. It says, "Now then, if you will indeed obey my voice," speaking clearly in this context to the Israelites, he says, "Now then, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be my own possession." The side column note says, special treasure. It says, "You will be my own possession among all the peoples, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the sons of Israel." Indeed, it was Israel who was his possession, his special treasure. Also, Deuteronomy 7 and verse 6. Verse 6, it says, "For you are a holy people," again without question, dealing with Israelites here, "for you are a holy people to Yahweh your God, and Yahweh your God has chosen you to be a people for his own possession out of all the peoples who are on the face of the earth." Only Israelites who had been divorced and or rejected by God could be bought back or redeemed by Yahweh. And you know what? You only find that word redeem used in regard to Israel. Listen to these passages. Isaiah chapter 5 and verse 59 and verse 20. Isaiah 59 verse 20, it says, "And a redeemer will come to Zion, and to those who turn from transgression in Jacob, declares Yahweh." He didn't come back to redeem all the world, because all the world wasn't his the way that Israel was. Israel was his treasure, his possession, his bride that he had divorced and sent abroad. They could be redeemed back, and that's why this verse says nothing about redeeming non-Jacobites or non-Israelites. Also, look at Luke chapter 1. Luke chapter 1 and verse 68, it says, "Blessed be the Lord God of Israel, for he has visited us and accomplished redemption for his people." Who were his people? The Israelites. Also, chapter 24 and verse 21. I believe this is the account of when, after Yeshua had resurrected, and two men were walking with him on the road. Chapter 24 and verse 21, it says, they responding to Christ, they say, "But we were hoping that it was he who was going to redeem
Israel. And again, you'll find that that term redemption is used only for Israel. And yet the term redemption or redeem is used in Galatians 5 in regards to those people called Jews and Greeks back up in chapter 3. Why? Well, very clearly, because those Jews and those Greeks as well were all Israelites. Jews, descendants of the house of Judah, Greeks, synonymous with the word Gentiles in the New Testament, descendants of the house of Israel. Consequently, the context again helps us in correctly identifying who those Greeks are. Which biblical application of the five can be applied to those Greeks or those Gentiles in chapter 3? They must be Israelite Gentiles because only Israelites could be redeemed by Yeshua. The third clue in Galatians 4 and verse 5 is the term the adoption of sons. Let's go back and let me read it to you again. Galatians 4 and verse 5, again it says, in order that he might redeem those who are under the law, that we might receive the adoption of sons. Well, whom do the scriptures say that the adoption of sons belong to? Now note, I did not ask you, who does your preacher say that the adoption of sons belong to? I said the scriptures. You know, I tell you the truth, I could really care less what your preacher has to say, whom the adoption of sons belong to, and you should really care less either. Your concern should be with who the scriptures say the adoption of sons belong to. Well, let's turn to a passage that clearly tells us. Romans chapter 9 and verse 4 again. You may not have caught it the first time, so let's read it again. Romans 9, verse 3 and 4. For I could wish that I myself were cursed, separated from the Christ for the sake of my brethren, my kinsmen according to the flesh, who are Israelites, to whom belongs the adoption of sons. Across this land, preachers today are telling you that anyone can be adopted as a son into God's family. But that's not the case, at least according to the scriptures. The adoption of sons belongs to Israel. Does that mean that other people from other nations cannot proselyte and put themselves underneath the covenant which belongs to Israel? No, they can. But that doesn't mean that they can be adopted as sons. Now, there's a fine line there. And some people certainly may have a hard time with that, but they'll have to admit their hard time is not with what I'm saying. Their hard time is with what God inspired Paul. And it's really not that difficult to understand, or it shouldn't cause such hard problems with people. Because at least from this preacher's standpoint, from what he understands in the scriptures, the covenants may not belong to non-Israelites, the law may not belong to non-Israelites, and the adoption of sons may not belong to non-Israelites. But again, that doesn't mean they cannot proselyte. The scriptures, I think, are very clear that they can. That they can place themselves under that adoption, under that covenant which belongs to Israel, and receive the benefits still thereof. Now, again, by this evidence, the Greeks in Galatians 3 and verse 28 must be Israelite Gentiles. I implore John Clark, when he receives these tapes, to go back and do just like he said, just like he encouraged those he preached to do. Go back and let the context determine who's being spoken of in these verses. And the context very clearly shows us that we have no choice but to use the one application that these Greeks or Gentiles in this passage are Israelites, specifically descendants from the house of Israel. Now, also turn to John chapter 7 and verse 35. For what is irrefutable evidence that the word Greek can be used to refer to Israelites, and in this passage certainly does. John chapter 7 and verse 35, it says, the Jews therefore said to one another, where does this man intend to go that we shall not find him? He is not intending to go to the dispersion among the Greeks and teach the Greeks, is he? Note the word dispersion there. This time it's been better translated than it was in 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 1. Again, it's the word, it's number 1290 in Strong's Concordance, the Greek word diaspora. And what was the definition? Israelite residents in Gentile countries. This is one of the three times it is used. And who is this dispersion? This dispersion is Israelites. But who else is this dispersion corresponded with? Greeks. Listen to it again. It says, he is not intending to go to the dispersion among the Greeks and teach the Greeks. Is he? He's going to the dispersion to teach the Greeks. And yet the word diaspora means Israelites in Gentile countries. Without question, that word Greek in Galatians 3:28 has at least the possibility of meaning Israelites among the rest of the Greeks. And the context proves that's the only conclusion that you and I can come up with. Now let me go back to Galatians chapter 3, verses. I want to read verses 26 through 29 to you again in the context of what I've just shared with you. 26, it says, "For you are all sons of God through faith in the Christ Yeshua. For all of us who were baptized into the Christ have been clothed with the Christ. There is neither Jew, descendants of the house of Judah, or Greek, descendants of the house of Israel. There is neither slave nor free man, there is neither male nor female, for you are all one in the Christ Yeshua. And if you belong to the Christ, then you are Abraham's offspring, heirs according to the promise." The "you" in verse 28 are identified as being Jews, descendants of the house of Judah, and Greeks, who in the context are descendants very clearly of the house of Israel, who had been under law, had been divorced by God and dispersed amongst the other Gentiles, dispersed to Galatia, whom Yeshua came to redeem, and to whom belonged the adoption of sons. Now let me ask you, honestly, does this passage spiritualize Israel? I caught you again. Yes, it does. Not in the sense that many people want to say that it does, but it does. This passage does spiritualize Israel. This passage declares that only physical descendants of Abraham who have become spiritual descendants of Abraham through salvation in Yeshua the Christ are true descendants of Abraham. Yes, it does spiritualize Israel, but not in the sense that so many today say that it does when they try to make any person of any nation who's come to Christ a spiritual descendant of Abraham. The context simply will not allow that interpretation. Yes, they can come to Christ, but that doesn't make them descendants of Abraham. Only those descendants of Abraham, physical descendants who have come to Christ, are spiritual descendants as well. In other words, Paul was dealing with Israelites who were under the misconception that simply being a physical descendant of Abraham was enough. But Paul pointed out that physical descent is not enough, and that there must be spiritual, that there must be a spiritual descent through Yeshua the Christ. And again, so much for those who say that we teach salvation by race. Now, very quickly, before closing this message out, I want to address one argument which some people attempt to use to counter what I've just demonstrated to you, specifically coming from verse 16 of Galatians 3. Verse 16, it says, "Now the promises were spoken to Abraham and to his seed." And then it says, "He does not say, and to seeds, as referring to many, but rather to one, and to your seed, that is the Christ." And again, this was an argument again on the tapes that, or a verse that John Clark again tried to use to say that, no, this is talking about spiritual descendants. Here's basically what they claim. They say, anyone can see from the from this verse and the contrast of the word seeds and seed that the blessings and salvation have nothing to do with physical descent. Now, there is, without a doubt, an obvious contrast here between singularity and plurality with what appears to be an indication in favor of singularity. But let me ask you this. That I concede without a problem. No one can get away from that from this verse. But let me ask you, if we use Galatians 3:16 in the fashion that they would like to have done, does it harmonize with what the rest of the Scriptures teach regarding the promises? Were the promises only made with the singular seed, Christ? Absolutely not. And that every preacher, again, across this country knows that's not the case. And the only time they'll make that argument is when they're referring to Galatians chapter 3, verse 16. Otherwise, they know, they agree that those promises were made with a multiplicity of seeds as well, in spite of what Galatians 3 and verse 16 says. Let's prove it. Let's go back to Luke chapter 1. Again, keeping in mind that in that one verse, there is a contrast between singularity and plurality. But listen to Luke chapter 1 in verses 54 and 55. It says, He has given help to Israel, His servant, in remembrance of His mercy, as He spoke to our fathers, to Abraham and his offspring, or seed, forever. Now guess what? That word offspring, as translated in the New American Standard, comes from the very same singular word, sperma, the Greek word, used in reference to Christ in Galatians 3 and verse 16. It's not a plural word. It's a singular word talking about a multitude of people. And so they know that those promises were also made to those people. Used without question in this context for a plurality of descendants. Also turn to Romans chapter 4. In verses 13 and 18. Verse 13, it says, For the promise to Abraham, talking about the same thing that Galatians 3 is. Paul, again, is the one writing it. He says, For the promise to Abraham, or to his descendants, singular seed, that he would be heir of the world, was not through the law, but through the righteousness of faith. And they might stop you there and say, that's saying the same thing that Galatians 3:16 is saying, and I agree. But they'll say, see, that seed there, that's been translated descendants in American Standard. I don't know if King James uses the word seed or not, but they say that could be referring to Christ alone. But it can't, because if you jump down to verse 18, it says, In hope against hope he believed, in order that he might become the father of many nations, according to that which had been spoken, so shall your descendants be. His descendants, singular word seed, or singular word, or the word sperma in the singular, is used for those people who would become not just Christ, but who would become a multitude of nations. The promise is very clearly, we're not only given to just Christ, or through it, just given to Christ, they were given to a multitude of descendants of Abraham. And again, they will not, in any other context, they will, I'm sure, agree to that. And even in Galatians 3, the same point can be easily proven. Galatians 3 and verse 29, listen to what it says. It says, And if you belong to the Christ, it's talking about, nobody's going to question, nobody's going to argue. It's talking, Paul is talking here about a multitude of people. It says, And if you, whoever it is, or how many, it says, If you belong to the Christ, then you are Abraham's offspring, heirs according to the promise. New American Standard translates it offspring, but it's the same Greek word sperma that's used for Christ. Up in verse 16, the singular word, not the plural word. Now in verse 16, the singular word is used for Christ, and yet in verse 29, the singular word is used for a plurality of people. So which is it? Both. As we've already demonstrated, only the seeds, Abraham's physical descendants, abiding in the one seed, Yeshua the Christ, are considered true seeds of Abraham's. All fits perfectly within the context and with the rest of what the Scriptures say, even more importantly. Vine's Expository Dictionary of New Testament Words even basically agrees with the same thing on verse 16. Part of their definition says, The point of the Apostle's argument is that since the fulfillment of the promises of God is secured alone by Christ, they only who are in Christ can receive them. In other words, the promises given to Abraham are not secured, again, by physical descent alone, but only for those who are spiritual descendants through Christ. And with that, let me implore you, if you've discovered your identity as an Israelite, but you know not Yeshua the Christ as Lord and Savior, let me implore you to make Him just that. Because the blessings and the promises are yours in and only through Him and His atoning sacrifice. Listen again, as I share with you even Paul's imploring for us to make that so through Christ. Galatians 3, 26 through 29, he says, For you are all sons of God through faith in the Christ Yeshua. For all of us who have been immersed into the Christ have been clothed with the Christ. There is neither Jew nor Greek. There is neither slave nor free man. There is neither male nor female. for you're all one in the Christ Yeshua. And if you belong to the Christ, then you are Abraham's offspring, heirs according to the promise. Physical descent alone won't cut it, people. We have got to be spiritual descendants as well, in and through Yeshua the Christ. Let's stand. We'll close in prayer. Our Heavenly Father, we come before you very thankful again, Father, for the sacrifice that was made on our behalf, the sacrifice that made it possible for us once again as physical Israelites to be in your good stead, knowing that we had in our transgressions and our disobedience been divorced and dispersed abroad. But Lord, that through Yeshua and your sacrifice in him, that you've made it possible for us to be once again reunited with you, and once again become the vessels through which and by which you can reach throughout to the rest of the world, the rest of the nations, to bring your kingdom to a worldwide stance. We thank you for that, Father, and we ask for the fulfillment. We ask that you'd indeed awaken your people to not only their identity, but, Father, to their responsibility to you, to each other, and to the rest of the world. We praise you and we ask you for these things, in and through Yeshua the Christ. Amen.